Hi, everybody, and welcome to another True Stories of Tinseltown. And I am very excited for my guest today. You guys are going to love him because I know so many of you love this man we are going to be talking about. And I am talking to author Carl Rollison. Hi, Carl. Welcome.
Oh, happy to be here.
I'm so glad we finally got to talk. And we are talking about this wonderful and I think handsome and, oh my God, your book. Just, you know, I learned so much. Dana Andrews. And the name of it is Hollywood Enigma, Dana Andrews. And this is the Hollywood Legends series. Did you edit all those, Carl?
I acquired them. That is, I deal with the authors. I look at proposals. I don't do this sort of line by line, page by page editing of the series, but I'm the one who sort of suggests authors, and the press will ask me about various subjects, or sometimes someone comes with a proposal, and so I look at all that material.
There are some great books. I read them. One I really loved, and I had the guest, was for Carolendas, a very beautiful girl.
Oh,
Carolendas.
Yeah.
I loved him. I can't think of his name, but he was so good. And he, you know, he loved Carol. I mean, so many writers, they get so into the people they're writing about because they learn everything.
Right.
And you, I have to say something about Carl before we go into our beloved Dana. How many books have you written? It's amazing.
Well, I've written 14, published 14 biographies, but altogether about 40 books.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. And you haven't done many on showbiz people. You did a couple on Marilyn, and you did one on Walter Brennan with the family's approval. What made you choose Dana?
There are a lot of reasons why. Partly what happens with biography, at least with me, since I'm a professional biographer, I'm always interested in subjects that interest me, that there's something in that subject that resonates. Before, many years before I knew I would do a biography of Dana Andrews, one of my favorite movies was the movie that made him a star, Laura. And one of the reasons I was so attracted to Laura, besides it being just a, you know, a brilliant motion picture.
One of my faves, too.
Yeah. Vincent Price, who's in Laura, of course, called it a perfect motion picture. He just really thought it was fantastic. So I used to watch that film probably once a year at least and saw it five or six times. Admired the style of the film, admired Dana's acting. And I have to tell you, there was something about the way Dana plays that character, his kind of understated,
curse
quality, holding back. With, you know, when he punches Vincent Price in the picture, that pent-up emotion, you know, comes out very briefly and very quickly, and you suddenly realize how much emotion is there. Well, that was my father. My father was a plainclothes detective. And so when I watched that film, and my father died when I was 13, it was a way of sort of understanding the kind of deep, almost hidden emotion that my father had. Then when I became editor of the Hollywood Legends series around 2010 or so, I got a call from the publisher at University Press in Mississippi who said that he had been contacted by one of Dana's daughters, Susan, and she was looking for someone to write a biography of her father. There had been a biographer who had gotten started back in the 1970s, and he just never followed through. He interviewed a lot of people and gathered material, but never came close to publishing the book. And so the editor, rather the publisher at Mississippi, asked me, did I know of anyone who might want to do a Dana Andrews biography? And I didn't hesitate. At that point, I didn't know, you know, what the family was like, really, other than knowing that the one of his daughters wanted a biography written. I didn't know how much material there was going to be, you know, whether he had an archive, whether there were letters, et cetera. I didn't know any of that. But when she said to me, do you know anyone who wants to write a Dana Andrews biography? I said, yes, I do. She said, who? And I said, me.
And she had a treasure trove for you, Carl, right?
Yeah. Susan had a tremendous amount of material. What happened was the publisher arranged for me to talk to Susan. And she started to explain, you know, her father was a letter writer. He kept a journal. Of course, there were a lot of film stills. There were family members still alive. You know, a lot of people in the family had a lot of brothers and sisters. There were a lot of people to talk to and so on. But the most important thing for me was I said to Susan, you know, I can see you're really keen to do this book, and so am I, but I have to tell you something right up front, which is I will take, you know, what you say, I want you to look at the book and certainly point out any mistakes or errors you might find, and, you know, even question interpretations and so on. But at the end of all this, it has to be my book. In other words, I wouldn't do what's called an authorized biography in the sense that, you know, someone has control over it. That
right.
If you're a literary estate or a family who either approves or they don't approve, I was essentially telling her, even if you disapprove, I'm going to do this book. And she was fine with that. And actually, that was a way of telling me something about Dana Andrews, that he raised a family was open, there were things about him. For instance, he was for a significant period of his life an alcoholic. They weren't upset about that. You know, they weren't saying, oh, let's not talk about that, or that's not important. They were quite willing because they loved him, and they knew that he was such a great subject that he could stand up to all that.
And he could. He's amazing.
Yeah,
and
he did.
I have to tell you that his, you know, I was shocked when I found out, when I'm reading it, he did a journal. It was a 10-year journal. But we should probably come to this. We'll just talk a little bit about Dana's upbringing.
Sure.
And he pretty much went to Hollywood quickly, so we'll get to there. But just briefly touch on where Dana came from.
Yes. He was a Texan, which anyone who watches Laura and watches that detective would never think that actor came from Texas.
Never.
I mean, for the movies, he lost all, you know, it was before the movies, actually, because he trained as an opera singer. He completely lost his Texas accent. But I'll tell you, it's a digression, but just quickly, I'll tell you that I was listening to him at a family gathering that someone made a recording of Dana. And when he started talking to his family, he lapsed into that Texas accent. It was so interesting because his own children in California, you know, those children grew up in California, there was no Texas accent there. But when he was with his brothers and sister, you know,
Isn't that cute?
Really
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah. One of his nieces has a copy of that recording.
Very cool.
Who I interviewed for the book. So anyway, he grew up in Texas. His father was a Baptist minister.
Yes.
And he was a very strict father, although he was like one of these Elmer Gantry types. He had affairs, and this was, in spite of the religiosity of the man, he was certainly a flawed human being.
Yes.
But he had two principles in life that was very firm that he used to preach about a lot. One of them was how terrible the movies were. You were sure to become a sinner if you became a devotee of the movies. And the other was drinking. He was a teetotaler, and he thought anyone, you know, who drank was a lost soul.
Going to hell.
So,
that's it.
Yeah, you're going doomed. To hell. So what does this Dana do? He becomes an actor and, as I say, for some time, an alcoholic.
But the irony
but Dana,
is that this guy did have affairs, and in your book you say that he and his brother stopped at one of the woman's house, and they were both like, ew. She's not cute enough for dad, but she was a poet and she was all these other things. But
that's right.
That they actually confronted her. And I thought that was kind of cute. Go on.
No, it's quite a story. The father, on the one hand, was this, you know, strict disciplinarian.
Fire and brimstone.
Baptist. And on the other hand, but he has this wayward son, Dana, who at one point runs away from home there in a small town in Texas. And he runs away to San Antonio, but of course loses his suitcase and doesn't have much money and, you know, has to sort of, you know, be sent back home by one of his father's friends. So he had this urge very early on to leave home. And by the time he got to college, I mean, he was, if you look at the photographs in my book, you know this. He was just a very handsome man.
Hubba hubba. I mean, just, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Yes.
Matinee idol looks, you know, when
incredibly
there were party,
handsome. Yeah.
When Dana's brothers would show up at a party, the girls would immediately say, "Is Dana coming?"
When was this, in their hometown?
Yeah, and they had various small, Rockdale, Texas, for example, various small towns where the father had ministries.
Where was Dana in? How many kids were there? I know Steve Forrest, was he the baby? That was his brother, the blondie.
He was the baby of the family. Yeah, he had. I've lost count. It was a big family.
Was
12,
it?
13 children.
Yeah,
a couple
thought.
Of children died in childbirth.
Yikes.
You know, it was.
Wasn't
yeah,
he, like, there were a lot of boys at first. Was he the second or third
yeah.
son?
Yeah, he was. Well, he was about third or fourth. I've forgotten now the birth order.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly wasn't the oldest. There was Wilton, for example. There were a couple others, and then Dana. And his father wanted him to be an accountant.
Yeah.
And Dana went to this teacher's college in Huntsville, Texas. And I saw his transcript, full of incompletes in accountancy, because he wasn't interested in accountancy. He was interested in acting, and he had a very good acting teacher who had come from Southern California and sort of encouraged him. And when Dana was, hardly 20, he left home and he spent a couple weeks in New York trying to get jobs acting. Nothing happened. He came back home. That was 1,500 miles away from
his
home.
That's huge.
In Texas.
And he was just a kid. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he went 1,500 miles in the other direction to California.
But then prior to leaving for California, he did go home, Texas.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I got to ask you about this woman, Carl.
Yeah.
This Norma woman who comes
Norma.
Up in your book quite frequently. And that was kind of an odd relationship, right? They were, I don't know, he went away and they were going to be engaged or something.
Yep.
And her family didn't want him to marry her.
Yeah, they were childhood sweethearts.
He kept all her letters.
She was the daughter of a very prominent merchant,
mm-hmm.
and her family wanted her to marry well. And they liked Dana. There wasn't anybody who didn't like Dana Andrews. I should say at that point, too,
right.
although Dana was his middle name, his first name is actually Carver,
uh-huh.
Carver Dana Andrews. And those two names, Carver and Dana, were the names of professors that his father admired from theological seminary.
Hmm.
So that's how he got the name Carver Dana. And then as a professional name, he dropped the Carver and just was Dana. But he from a very early age was just, determined to make something of himself. And her family, Norma's family, thought that what he wanted to do, to be an actor, was so outside the convention of things. Would he be a provider? Could he support his family? They liked him, but they just felt at one point they sent her off, on a European tour.
Yes.
Because they thought maybe she could forget Dana. And he stayed loyal to her, she stayed loyal to him, and then he went to California. And she wasn't willing. Her parents then ran into trouble, and she felt she couldn't leave home. He did come back once or twice, but he felt, his life was no longer there. She wasn't really quite prepared to move to California, and then he met somebody else.
Yeah.
That was his first brief marriage. His first wife died in childbirth, in fact.
Yes. And they had a son.
They had a son by the first wife. And then the wife died. In the meantime, Dana, he's in Hollywood. When he gets to Hollywood in 1930, that's the Depression.
Yeah.
Talk about the worst time in the world, and he goes to these studios and sort of says, "Here I am," And they say, well,
ho-hum.
That's nice. You yeah. know, what are your what are your acting credits? And they basically ignore him. And for a good 7-8 years, he did community theater. He trained as an opera singer. He had a very good voice.
Did you ever hear him sing, Carl?
Sorry?
Did you ever hear him sing?
Did I ever hear him sing? I never heard him sing opera, which is what I would dearly love to have done. As far as I know, there are no recordings. He did do public performances, but none of those were recorded. The only time I heard him sing, actually, believe it or not, is on the Perry Como show.
Huh. Was it like a Christmas special or something?
He was promoting a film, a film with Betty Hutton. And the film has a theme song, and he doesn't sing the theme song in the film, but on Perry Como, he sang the theme song.
Was he good?
So you can hear him sing on that old television show, and then there's a film, The North Star, which he briefly, a bunch of characters sing as they're walking down a road, but it's a very, very brief segment. He did a musical, State Fair, and he didn't even tell them he could sing because he was afraid that he wouldn't get serious acting parts, that they would think he was, you know, Dick Hames or somebody, that they would just stick into a musical. And he wanted to be a leading man.
And he looked like a leading man. So,
yeah.
So he went out to Hollywood to become an actor. What made him swerve to start training in opera?
I think that comes out actually of church singing.
Ah.
And his mother, in fact, at one point says to him, you know, oh, if you, you know, I would love for you to be an opera singer. In other words, that was one way for him to be, and he loved to sing, of
yes.
course. But that was one way for him to do something that his parents, especially his mother, would have approved of. Whereas acting was, that's the den of iniquity, you know,
right.
that's evil. And you know, I think his father would have made peace with it. His father died just before Dana became a star. And I think the father was already saying things like, you know, now that he could see his son look like his son was going to be successful, he said, you know, maybe, because his father had a ministry in California once, which really didn't work out, and he went back to Mississippi. Went back to Texas. The father says in one of his last letters, he's, maybe you could get a house for us out here in California. The father was beginning to come around, you know. To
Dana
Dana's
had a
point.
Boat, the nice lifestyle.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He married that woman. He had a son, David.
Yeah.
And they basically, what was it, the mother or was it the wife's, his dead wife's sister that was watching David?
The mother was watching David.
I love
the
when
sister
she found
watched that. Over oh. too, but it was basically the mother-in-law who was watching over the first child, David.
And she found a tin of condoms. I laughed so.
Yeah, hard. She found a tin of condoms. You know, it was very hard. You know, Dana was only married about 2 years. His wife dies.
They were wealthy, weren't they? They were kind of.
They were very wealthy. Yes, they were. They were. There was quite a wealthy, well-established family. Yeah, you know? And he you know, he wanted to do right by his son. He was a young, vigorous man. He wanted to date women as well,
sure,
and so that was a very tough relationship to negotiate. So he's, you know, he trained as an opera singer, and he's doing community theater. He's not making a lot of money. And he's pumping gas, which is what my father did in the Depression in California. And in fact, Dana and my father could have met. I don't think they did, but I mean, they could have. They were contemporaries. They were born in the same year. So Dana's pumping gas, and he's got these two owners who hear him singing while he's pumping gas. They say, well, you know, you appear to have some talent, and they actually bankroll him. You know, they say, we will support you until you make it big.
His benefactors.
Yes, his benefactors.
And he was at the, when did he go to Pasadena Playhouse, which was actually kind of a big thing?
Yeah, mid-30s.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1935. That was a big opportunity for him, because that's one of the things about being at the Pasadena Playhouse is Hollywood agents would come and see. You know, there were actors like Victor Jory were there and several other actors. Robert Preston, his name at the time was Preston Meservey. And wow, he didn't become Robert Preston until he started making movies.
Yeah.
That was a big break for Dana to be at the Playhouse, and he was very popular, and he was in all sorts of dramas, comedies, and tragedies, and ultimately an agent does spot him, an agent for Sam Goldwyn, wants to sign him to a contract. But you know, early on, they didn't think that Dana was leading man material.
Where? At the studios or at Pasadena Playhouse?
No, the studio. The studio thought he would be maybe like, as he was in some of his early films, the second lead, like in a movie Crash Dive, where Tyrone Power is the lead and Dana is the second lead. And there's a Bell Star Dana does, in which he's, again, the second lead, and Randolph Scott is the star. So it took a while, and it was really until Laura, that anyone thought he could really carry a picture by himself.
An agent said he photographed heavy and would only do character parts in his journey.
Yeah,
he felt fear and doubt over everything.
Right.
I have to tell you guys, if you love Dana and you see this stoic man on screen, he is a mush. He's a romantic. He writes beautiful letters to his wife. He meets his second wife at the Pasadena Playhouse.
At the Pasadena Playhouse, Mary. Yes, yes.
And he's married to her until he dies.
Yeah, so that was a love match. And she was so important to him. She knew more about the theater than he did. She was an accomplished actress. At one point, they were scouting her. Hollywood was scouting her, and he was very worried because he wanted a conventional wife and a conventional family, and he was afraid. He knew how talented Mary was. That if she signed a Hollywood contract, that things might not work out with two actors in the family, so to speak. But she made a decision. She decided that she really wanted to be his support, and she did want children, and she did want a family. And the story, a lot of Hollywood stories don't have happy endings, but in their case, it did, because once those children were grown, she returned to acting, and she did theater with
Dana. I love that.
But it's a marvelous, you don't often get, someone's a marvelous writer or a marvelous actor, and, you look at their background, and you find all sorts of things that aren't so admirable.
Right.
And I can deal with that. I know that people are flawed and have problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, with Dana Andrews, well, actually, an actor who's still alive, he's 104, Norman Lloyd.
He's something else, isn't he?
Yeah, and he said, Dana was one of nature's noblemen. He wrote me another letter. He called Dana a prince among men. And that's not hyperbole. That's not exaggeration.
I believe it. But you have to say, Scott, given Dana's roles, he seems so, he just seems so serious and so troubled. And so, and to read about him and that his second wife was full of life and funny.
Yeah.
And she lightened him up a lot. Because
she did.
He was much more serious. But he was a romantic. I mean, he was writing her beautiful love letters long into their marriage.
Yes.
He was. Swoon.
He was really quite something. He at one point he thought about being a writer, and you can see why.
He had very well.
Yeah, he had the sensitivity.
Very much so.
Yeah, to do that kind of thing. But acting became such a vehicle of expression for him. And he had so wanted to be a success. I think that overcame everything. And yet, if we go back to the title of my book, Hollywood Enigma, he is a conflicted character, like some of the characters he plays.
Yes, he is.
You know, he gets what he wants, and yet when he gets it, it's troubling. Hollywood was not, you know, think of, you know, the women that he acted with, you know, not just Jean Tierney, but, you know, Merle Oberon.
Joan Crawford. That's a funny story.
Yeah, Joan Crawford. You know, he acted with Susan Hayward. You know, he acted with the best. And Noah Fares, you know. With Joan Crawford, she would certainly have welcomed an affair with Dana Andrews.
Yes, she said she in your book it said she tried for both.
Daisy
Canyon,
both. Henry Fonda, and they were both in the film with her.
I thought Dana was incredibly charming in that film. He did. It was sort of a different kind of role for him. How you doing, Cup? I don't know what he called everybody, sweetie or something. I don't know.
But, yes, he did. Right.
It was Henry Fonda, Dana, and Joan.
Yeah.
And Joan wanted either. And in the book, it says she gave Henry some sort of a bejeweled jockstrap.
That's right. Yeah.
Sorry, now, Joan.
Dana would be amused by something like that, but it wouldn't turn him on. It wouldn't be something, you know, that he would conceive of doing, you know. And he wasn't a prude, nothing like that. But he just he saw his acting in Hollywood, as Jimmy Cagney did too, as a job, as a profession, and he wasn't going to mess it up with some kind of, you know, an affair on the side. He just wasn't for him. Plus, he was in love with his wife, and he loved his family. And it's a curious thing. There are, you know, the movie magazines when he was a star show him with his family and, you know, being very domestic. And often those things are fake. You know, the actors really don't spend any time at home, and they're out chasing women and the rest of it. But it was true of Dana. It's funny, you know, movie magazines were supposed to be fairy tales. Well, in a way, the fairy tale was true.
Well, I post pictures, you know, on my website and on my Facebook page and things like that. And I love the pictures with Dana and his children, and you just see it. And also, Dana, when he got married, when he had the beard, oh, my God, was he so cute.
Yes. Yes, yeah.
Was that with the first wife when he had the beard, or was that with Mary?
No, that was with Mary, actually, yeah.
You know, so he started, and he got The Westerner, and then he got this. And I think this was the big boom for him, and I believe you believe that's right, too, is the Oxbow Incident, which...
Yes, yes.
Oh, my
it's
God.
It's a very moving scene where he plays this innocent man who is lynched. Yeah, it's so moving.
He writes a letter to his wife. He wants to write a letter. Wrongly accused. There's a lynch mob, and three men are wrongly accused of murder.
Yeah.
And they don't take him to court. They just, you know, I hate that whole lynch mob mentality. It's because if they were alone, they wouldn't do it. But Dana, he is so... Oh, God. I've seen it once. I can never see it again. I mean, he was wonderful. He was perfect. But the whole thing, I just can't take.
It's painful.
It's really painful. I cry my eyes out. And I love Dana. And I just say bravo to that job. And that's when they really, really started noticing, don't you think?
Yeah, that's when he really got noticed. Yeah, they said, wow, you know, this is, it really made a difference. It's funny, though, it took him from, I think his first contract was signed in 1939, so it's almost, you know, 1943, 44 before he gets that break in Laura.
So then he was like 35 or something.
He was, yeah, he was in his mid-30s, that's right.
Huh.
But that happens a lot with men in Hollywood. I mean, Bogart was around, of course, in the 30s, but it's not till really the end of the decade with Casablanca, where he's in his, you know, early 40s that he becomes a leading man. He was
always
a character actor.
Yeah. And Dana, he was there. I'm looking at some of the work he did, and he did some wonderful stuff. And, of course, he followed up Laura. Oh, and was it true that Clifton Webb had a mad, passionate crush on Dana?
There are a couple of funny letters from Clifton Webb and Dana certainly, you know, was heterosexual in every sense of the word, but Dana admired clothes and style. And Clifton Webb had tremendous sense of style in what he wore. One of the first things when Dana got on the set of Laura and started acting with Clifton Webb, he asked him, "Who, you know, who's your tailor?" he wanted to have well-cut clothes that Clifton Webb certainly wore.
I loved your part in the film where you are going a little deeper into what you see going on with Dana, where he just thinks, you know, well, it's just a dame, you know, one dame got me to get.
Yeah.
But you saw it so different in his tailored clothes and different things. You had sort of a different outside life for him, which was very fascinating.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that, Carl. I thought that was really.
Yeah. Thank you.
I love the book. I can't. I was so thrilled to find that. Again, he did The Best Years of Our Lives, which he was amazing in, playing Fred Derry. And they were all wonderful, Dana and the whole cast.
That's a remarkable film. It really holds up.
It does hold up. It's just...
William Wyler's the director. He had come back from the war. He had, in fact, lost a good part of his hearing during the war and wanted to make a picture about it. And Samuel Goldwyn really bankrolled the picture and wanted it to be done just right. And Dana had spent the war years not in the service, but he had spent a lot of time with servicemen. He really understood what it was like for these men to come back home. And I don't know if you remember the scene in the film. For me, it's one of the most shocking scenes I've ever seen in a Hollywood film. When Fred Derry goes home to his parents. And when you look at the home they're living in.
Right. Literally is, on the other side of the railroad tracks. He literally
on the other
walks
side
across
of the, track.
The tracks. Yes. Yeah.
Here's this well-spoken, you know, man who's Fred Derry, who's distinguished himself in the war, you know, wonderful war record. All his wife wants him to do is wear his uniform.
Oh, she was wonderful. And, what a horrible woman.
Yes, exactly.
She was wonderful.
Yeah, but that's what the film is making such a statement about the war, how you could take someone who Dana was a, you know, if people still remember what this is, he was a soda jerk.
Yep.
He was, you know, he was waited on the counter at a soda fountain in a drugstore.
Right.
And he became, you know, a bombardier. You know, he became a war hero. And his story, Fred Derry's story, you know, it's a story of many, many men. And that's what Dana understood. He understood that he was really expressing, you know, the lives of these other men. And it's such a tribute to this country. You know, that's one of the things that Hitler never counted on. He said, oh, those Americans are soft. They don't know what war is. They're not going to be prepared for it, you know. And he was really foolhardy declaring war on the United States when he was already involved in a war in Russia and with Britain. But that Fred Derry character tells us so much.
Yes, and his PTSD, or what they called shell shock at the time.
Right.
Those nightmares he had. You can't even imagine what these poor men have seen and been through
in the
war. You lose your friends. I just don't know how anyone comes out okay. It would. Just would go probably crazy. I couldn't handle it.
And I don't know if I said this in the book, but when Fred Derry gets, you know, falls in love
with Teresa Wright.
Yes, with Peggy, right, Teresa Wright. When that happens, the father, played by Frederick March, you know, essentially tells him, you know, well, you're not good enough for my daughter. Well, that's exactly what Norma's parents said to Dana. You're not good enough.
He was good enough to be friends with in the uniform. He was good enough.
Great guy,
heck of a guy.
Right. Yeah, the camaraderie of war and so on. But now back in peacetime, these sort of class differences, economic differences, are being restored.
Right, and there's home or middle class.
Yeah.
Frederick March character Al, yes. You know, their upper middle, and yeah. Fred, other side of the tracks. I mean, his parents are alcohol. Well, she's a stepmother.
Yes.
Gladys George. And he's in so many movies, but I just don't know his name, who played Fred's father. But it's a wonderful
film. Yes, I can't
film.
Remember. Yeah, it is a wonderful
and
film.
It just, it really concentrates and shows you that it's just not like, hey, 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 I'm home. You know, you yes. have to work.
That's for sure.
Everybody, for your wives, your girlfriend,
yeah.
for your kids, sisters, and brothers, and most especially for you, because you've been through the mill for these past few years and trying to reconnect and seeing things differently, like Al does at the bank and Fred. And, you know, yeah. Marie was just some hotsy-totsy number, but, you know, I don't think they were like weekend wedding, I think, kind of thing. He met yeah. her. And it's just a wonderful film, and it's one of my favorite. Those two are my favorites of Dana's.
Oh, yeah.
And I can watch them over and over and over again. Scott, I've read lots of stuff about Dana and his ability to remember lines. No matter how much he drank, he'd come over hungover. When did he start right. to really hit the bottle?
I think it came right... actually, I think just before Laura, he had been in Hollywood for several years. He really disliked the kind of milieu, corrupt kind of atmosphere, even though in so many ways he rebelled against his father.
Yes.
I think in a way the father still had this enormous impact on the son. I think the son still had a sense of probity and integrity that simply Hollywood could, you know, it just, what am I doing here? Even though this is what he wanted, I think he was conflicted in that sense. And he writes a letter, in fact, to his brother Charles. Charles is one of the brothers who died quite young that Dana was quite close to.
Yeah, he moved to, wasn't he in L.A.? Charles?
Yes,
moved
he was
first.
In L.A. too. The brothers yeah. were very close. And he writes to Charles and he says, you know, I'm really disgusted with this, you know. And then what happens, you know, he's disgusted with the way these agents and these producers and, you know, you were signed to contracts. You were, you know, it sounds very glamorous, and it was in many ways. But in other ways, you were an indentured servant.
Yeah, you were like a piece of meat.
There was a morals clause, and mm-hmm. you had to watch yourself in many, many ways. And I think that was very difficult. And Dana, it was very difficult for him to handle, to take those pressures, to go to Hollywood parties, you know, for example, and say nice things to producers and so on. Dana was such an honest person. He would say honest things, which would get him in trouble, whether he was drinking or not. So, but I think the drinking was, well, there are a couple things. One thing, one of my other subjects, William Faulkner, said this about drinking. Faulkner said, I have one drink and I feel good. Have another drink, I feel even better. Have a third drink, there's no stopping me.
Wow.
I think it for some people, and certain kinds of men, it's that euphoria and that sense of omnipotence. And at the same time where, for instance, he had a battle with the studio about Daisy Kenyon. You know, he's wonderful in Daisy Kenyon.
He really
but he wanted
is.
To play Henry, yeah, he wanted to play Henry Fonda's part. He wanted to get the girl. You know, Fonda gets Joan Crawford at the end of the film, and Dana wanted that role. I think he could have played either role.
He could have played either role easily. And I think it would have been kind of nice to see Dana in that role.
Yeah, but the studio sent him a letter and said, you know, you're under contract, you're going to do this film. So he did. Of course, he did it. And he did it well.
Very well. I liked him very much in that.
He always, as you said, no matter how much of the drinking, he would always be the consummate professional. But as with a lot of alcoholics, you know, you reach a stage. By the early 1950s, there were episodes where Dana blanked out. where he didn't show up. Even in the best years of our lives, there were a couple days when William Wyler said, "Dana, if you're going to show up in such bad shape, take off a day or two. We'll shoot around you." And Dana thought that was, what a wonderful person Wyler was for saying that. But word got around.
Yeah.
You know, by the mid to late 1940s, Dana's a leading man, but who's coming up? Gregory Peck.
Mr.
And
Nice.
Some of the roles that Dana could have gotten, Peck got, because not only was he a little younger and sort of the new, somebody new, but there wasn't this whole drinking problem to deal with.
Yeah, and Dana, he did some good. I'm trying to find the filmography of the 50s and what he did. They said after his brother died,
Elephant Walk.
He began drinking like crazy.
Yeah, yeah. That was a very troubled picture with Elizabeth Taylor and Peter Finch.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it was supposed
Finch
to
was
star.
Finch was a huge drinker, too.
Yes. Elephant Walk, you guys.
Lee was supposed to be in it and then was replaced by Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, because Lee and Finch were having a torrid affair, and, you know, Laurence Olivier knew it, but Peter Finch, and she was, manic depressive, and they had to get her out of there, and they brought in Elizabeth.
Yes.
And I thought Dana was good in that movie.
I did, too.
I thought he was very good in it. I liked him
a lot. Yeah, in fact, I thought that the Peter Finch character was so disagreeable in Elephant Walk, I couldn't understand why Elizabeth Taylor didn't just go off with Dana.
Me either. I felt that. I haven't seen it in so long, but, you know, even before I really got into Dana, I'm like, I like him, and I don't like him. And Let these two ride off in an elephant together, will they, please? He also did, what did he do Beyond a Shadow of a Doubt? That was just on TCM the other night on Nora.
Yeah, that was in the mid-1950s with Fritz Lang. He did two films back-to-back in 55 and 56, While the City Sleeps and Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Yeah.
Was he the priest in While the City Sleeps? Was he a priest in that, or is that another one with Gene Tierney?
Yeah, that's a different one. Yeah, that's earlier, the late 40s. Yeah. No, in While the City Sleeps, he's a reporter. He's a reporter who's also kind of a TV journalism star as well in that film. That's a wonderful cast, While the City Sleeps. There's Dana, there's Vincent Price.
Oh, I love that. Arlene Dahl plays his wife.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
There are some wonderful character actors. And then she almost steals the show, Ida Lupino.
Oh, she was great in that.
When she comes into a bar and orders a drink and puts a cigarette in her mouth, it is so suggestive. It's just incredible.
She was quite the dame. Ida was something else. She was quite a lady. One movie I forgot to talk about, but I found this very funny, is Dana did not want to do Fallen Angel. Is it because he had done too many, which I absolutely love this film. Linda Darnell and the woman that they gave her the role because she always does the musicals, Alice Faye.
Alice Faye, right.
And he said Alice Faye used to call him at night and he wanted nothing to do with her. And Linda Darnell, he actually gave Linda like this soul smooch in the movie. I was like, oh my God, Dana, yikes.
Yeah.
But I liked the movie. I thought it was very good.
I think, Dana did not want to do the movie. There were things about small town life in the movie that he said, he just said, weren't realistic. Sometimes actors, and this is true of writers as well, they don't always know or appreciate what their best work is. For me, Fallen Angel is right at the top.
I agree, too. I can watch that over and over. I love that movie.
And not just in terms of Dana's performance, but the whole film.
It's great.
When Linda Darnell walks into that diner, it takes off her shoe and crosses her legs. Oh, my God.
She eats his hamburger.
And the world stands still. And then there's this marvelous scene with Ellis Day. You know, she's the one that Dana marries really for her money.
Money, yeah. And she's like character. A virginal character where
yes.
certainly and, Lita Darnell is
yeah.
not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And the Ellis Day character, after she's married, they go to, I think it's San Francisco, to get money out of the bank.
Right.
Because Dana's going to get off with this.
Because he refuses. We won't tell you why, but they go there.
Yeah. Yeah, the character refuses, the Ellis Day character refuses to let him be a con man. That is, they're in a bedroom together, in a hotel room, rather, and she goes into the bathroom, and she's taking a bath or something. She asks him to hand some clothing to her, and she does all this in an absolutely matter-of-fact, married woman sort of way,
yes.
and she completely destroys his conception of himself as a con man taking advantage of her. It's one of the most brilliant scenes I've seen in any movie ever. I mean, he just, his whole life, you know, where he's thought so poorly of himself, she just turns it around.
You know,
it's just astonishing.
It is. And the thing was, what really irked, well, I'm sure she was hot for Dana, I don't blame her, when she was calling him all the time. But
yeah.
She was supposed to have, this was supposed to be her breakout and drama role.
Right.
I thought she was very good in this. I really did.
Yes.
And as I did all the characters. And so I get, but then, you know, there's Linda Darnell, and how can you not? She was so great. And so, you know, sleepy, slowy, slutty, she was great. And Charles Bickford was great as well. The creepy detective.
Absolutely.
But she watched the movie, and she got into her car. She watched the finished product. She got in her car and never came back to the studio. She quit.
That's right. Yeah.
I wonder what they cut. Jeez.
I think, just like Dana, I think she didn't realize what had occurred. That is, Linda Darnell's sensational, but of course, Linda Darnell, her character dies halfway through the film.
Right.
And, you know, and Ellis Day is really one who picks up the pieces, and I do think her acting is superb.
I do, too. And I love her in this role, and I think sympathetic, and I think she's attractive, and I can see...
Yeah.
I just really like her a lot, so...
Yeah.
It's one of my top Dana's movies as well.
So
What else did he make in the 50s? I'm trying to think. He made a couple of. He made that one where he's the pilot.
Yeah, Zero Hour, which is in some ways, that was a comeback film for him in the sense that I found this letter in which his agent was telling the producers, Dana's going to come through for you because the stories about the drinking and again were so bad after Elephant Walk, and this film Zero Hour comes after that. And Dana really, that's a wonderful film. That's a very taut, both in terms of his performance and the scripting of the film. Zero Hour
is in that as well, isn't she?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. She's on the plane. That's right. Yeah, she's in that.
He did
this film with Jacques Tourneur, the director Jacques Tourneur, Night of the Demon.
He's even good in that. It's this horrible monster thing, but he's very good. I actually, you know, I've watched it, and it's not like something I scoff at. You know, the worst thing I ever saw Dana do, and it broke my heart. Hulu has all these, and a lot of these places, they have like MeTV or whatever, but I saw it on Hulu, Family Affair. And he did an episode of Family Affair with Brian Keith, and he played a friend of Uncle Bio's, and he had just gotten out of the slammer because I guess he had embezzled some money. And so Buffy and Jody, the little cherubs, hear this and say, he stole money. And so poor Dana comes in and sees the two little goblins hiding their piggy bank from him. I think, no, Dana.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that was the worst. True. But he might have been friends with Brian Keith. Who knows? Yeah. He also did Airport 75. He had that part. Boom. Yeah.
He did a fair amount of TV. Yeah, he did some good things. He did an early early TV performance with Robert Redford, with Redford playing his son.
Huh.
He did a very interesting Playhouse 90 episode. There are a number of TV. I've often thought about Dana's later career and what would have made him an even bigger star, what would make people recognize him even more. He did this film for Elia Kazan, Boomerang, in which he plays a state's attorney.
Yes.
In Connecticut. And it's a marvelous film, and he sort of semi-documentary film. And his performance is great, but I was thinking, imagine if it's, and I think Raymond Burr was terrific, but imagine if Dana had been cast as Perry Mason.
He would have been great. Wasn't he on Perry Mason? I know he's on Ironside.
Yeah.
He did much. His actor filmography, yeah. I'm pulling it up here. He was even on, my goodness, The Love Boat?
Yeah.
He was on Falcon Crest. I have to ask my friend David Selby about that. He comes on his show. He doesn't tell me that he was on that. He was on The Hardy Boys. Oh, my goodness. Ellery Queen.
Yeah, he was on a number of things like that. Yeah. Yeah. He did a couple of really good Twilight Zone episodes too.
Yes, and he did The Night Gallery. He did Name of the Game. Here it is. He played Harv Mullen on Family Affair. Hot Rod to Hell. Oh my God, what a movie.
Yes, yeah. You know what he disliked about that is they made him dye his hair.
What color was his hair?
He was perfectly well, he was going gray at that point.
And he's handsome. And then, he was a handsome and Hot Rod, so, guy.
He didn't want to dye his hair, but they said, no, you got to dye your hair for this movie.
I actually enjoyed it. And I have to say, Jean Crane was still just luscious in this film.
Yeah.
She's still beautiful, but, it's not my favorite film. But if it comes on every so often, I have to say, geez, let me check out Hot Rods from Hell. I'm seeing it. Johnny Rein, The Frozen Dead. I remember that one. Battle of the Bulge, he was in.
Yeah.
Did he play Brainstorm? Remember that? I think Anne Francis was in this and Jeffrey Hunter. And he's like, this wealthy man.
It's one of the few films, Brainstorm is one of the few films in which Dana plays a villain.
A real villain, a horrible villain.
A real villain. And it reminds me a lot of the early Robert Duvall, a film of Coppola's called The Conversation, in which Robert Duvall has a very small role, but he's the husband of a woman who, as it turns out in the film, the woman's younger lover and the woman plot to kill the Robert Duvall character. And that, there's a kind of meanness in the way Duvall plays a character that reminded me of Dana. Dana almost always played good guys or conflicted heroes, but very few sort of out and out mean or evil characters. And Brainstorm's interesting. He really does very well in that role. He does a number of minor roles toward the end of his career in films that are quite good.
But as you said, when he left Hollywood, didn't he do some singing on Broadway with his wife? She was in the plays with him. Or were they just straight?
He did Dinner Theater with her.
Mm-hmm.
He did, he replaced Henry Fonda in one Broadway play. Another Broadway play, which was about Admiral Rickover, the nuclear submarine man, that didn't do so well. Did well in Philadelphia, actually, but didn't play well in New York. And then he did this Dinner Theater circuit with his wife Mary, doing a lot of comedy, which is something that he almost never got a chance to do in Hollywood.
I loved him in Ball of Fire as gangster. He was adorable.
Yeah, he's very good as a gangster in Ball of Fire,
He was so cute. These are funny. These are allegedly personal quotes regarding his
album. He has a nice fist fight with Gary Cooper.
Yes. It's not difficult for me to hide emotion on screen since I've always hidden it in my personal life. And I believe, I guess when he's family, because I see him with his children, he has this big, bright smile, but he's not a guy who really smiled on screen too often.
Not very often, no.
He said on his alcoholism. Finally, I said to myself, you're a miserable man. Whether or not you want to remain miserable is up to you. So I quit. And then on a psychiatry thing, trying to find out why I drank, I finally ended up with the president of an American Psychiatry Association in Hartford telling me, I'm damned if I know why you drink. And he quit. And he was one of the first ones to come out as an alcoholic. He did a commercial, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did a couple commercials for the transportation secretary. Quite honest, quite above board about what it was like and how dangerous it was to drink and drive. He wasn't at all embarrassed about it. And when William Holden died, who was also an alcoholic, Dana talked about that. And some people were angry with Dana for, you know, talking about Holden's alcoholism. But for Dana, it was something that, you know,
he related
people should
to.
Know.
And that he
related to, and you know, he was good friends with Dana. Was good friends with Ronald Reagan, although they didn't share politics very much. But he described a meeting with lunch that he had with William Holden and Ronald Reagan and Dana, and they sat down and let's have a drink, you know, before lunch or dinner. I can't remember which it was, and so Holden and Dana have a drink, and Ronald Reagan has a drink, and before, you know, anyone starts eating, Dana and Holden are ordering more drinks, and Ronald Reagan says, you know, aren't you going to have one? And Reagan says, no, I already had one.
Oh boy, fun!
they were just getting started.
Right, the night is young. Schmeat, I'll eat 11. So William had a horrible death. I mean, he could have lived. He fell, hit his head, and they said he did not die. And he was found
dead, found days later. Yeah.
Which is so heartbreaking, and he really aged. So Dana then got Alzheimer's, right?
He did, ultimately. I think it wasn't Alzheimer's. It's often called Alzheimer's. I think he had dementia. The reason I make the distinction is that with Alzheimer's, especially toward the end, there's a lot of physical deterioration. And Dana's daughter said to me, he was handsome to the day he died. You know, he did lose his mind. He did suffer from dementia. And at the end, he ended up not knowing who he was. And holding hands with the woman who knew who he was.
Yeah.
In the care institution he was in. But apparently he never physically deteriorated, which is why the family thinks it wasn't actually Alzheimer's, although he was in a home for Alzheimer's patients. So it's easy to see why people, you know, assume that it was Alzheimer's. But I don't actually think the diagnosis was Alzheimer's.
Can you confirm or deny this for me? Did Burt Lancaster visit Dana and he had a stroke while visiting Dana?
That seems to be an apocryphal story. I was never able to document that.
Yeah, so it could be, could skeptical. Not be. Yeah, so who knows?
Yeah, for sure, I don't know.
So Dana, how old and how did Dana finally die? Because he lived a good long life, actually.
Yes, he did. Yeah. He lived into the 1992, I think it was, he died, born in 1909. And I think just of natural causes.
So he didn't have a stroke or anything. He died of the...
I don't believe so. Yeah,
old age. Believe. The dementia of the old age. Just sort
old
of
age.
Something like that. Well, I have to say, Carl, I loved your book. It is a book.
Great.
I reread books, you know, and I... We'll definitely reread because sometimes I miss things. But I have to tell everybody, this is a wonderful book. Carl did a great job, and you can tell that he really likes Dana. You know, some authors are like, rah, rah, rah. They write kind of crappy stuff about people. But you definitely like your Dana. And Hollywood Enigma, Dana Andrews, it's from the Hollywood Legends series. You can get it now. It is a wonderful book. I love Dana. There's so much we didn't get to. You can read his diary. You can read his journal that he did for 10 years. He stopped before he became a star.
That's right.
The journal. That's funny, isn't it? I guess he didn't have time anymore.
Well, it was about his wishes and aspirations, and in a sense, they were fulfilled.
True. Yeah. And a lot of letters. And you got he was a marshmallow. He loved. He wrote beautiful love letters. He was sensitive. He was insecure. He was just an all around guy. And I just thought he was a fabulous actor. And of course, a tall drink of water. Really.
Yeah.
I love him. I think he's great. So, Carl, you are wonderful. And everybody, check out Carl. Go to his – do you have a website, Carl, where they can look? I know you can go to Amazon and look at his author page or
– Yes, the website is just my name, carlrollison.com.
Yes, that's how I found you, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just read your book. Yeah, so thank you so much for coming on. I enjoyed this immensely. And
that was my pleasure.
This is fun. And I will, this is going to go on, like I said, in Seattle for the vintage thing, and I'll go on for my own thing. And he has so many fans, and he wrote a beautiful book. And what did his daughter say? What did his family say after they read your book?
I'm sorry?
What did his family say after you finished the book?
Well, I think they got a good look at it before it was published, and they loved it. You know,
how could they not?
They felt it really represented. I think what they were especially pleased about, even more than about Dana, is that I really. Really made into a person that you could identify with, his wife, Mary.
I loved her. She was such, loved her. You did make her into a very vivid person. And I thought she was great. And wonderful book, Carl, all I can tell you.
Well, thank you. I'm really grateful for getting the chance to talk to you.
And I am grateful you had time to talk to me about one of my favorite actors, underrated, I might add, in Hollywood. And you wrote just a great a biography of him. So check it out, you guys. I know you're out there because we talk about him. It's a wonderful book. And Carl has written many. So thank you so much, Carl. I so appreciate this.
Thanks again, Grace.
Hope we talk soon, and I will let you know all the scoop. Okay?
Oh, good. Yes, thank you.
Take care, Carl. Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye-bye.